You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
And with that groovin' 1960s tune, we could only be talking about Jerry and Sylvia Anderson's classic cult TV series, UFO. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And you're listening to Fusion Patrol. So, in 1969, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson produced for British television the program known as UFO. Jerry and Sylvia Anderson had previously produced a number of other programs that you may be aware of.
Yeah, they had been doing a type of show called Super Marionation. Super Marionation, something to do with obviously marionettes, but the technique in which they were used and the way they were filmed kind of made them look more like. It gave them more action and just not look like silly little puppets. And the shows were kind of sci-fi in nature, but for kids. Shows like, I'm going to date myself here, Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, and there's one or two others that I can't quite remember. Those are the ones that I watched. And they were fantastic shows. They were really enjoyable to watch for me as a kid because it had something that I could really appreciate at my young age, and that's Super Marionation.
And afterwards, although UFO was a bit of a cult classic program, they also went on to produce the more famous Space 1999, which bears some familial connections to it, which we'll talk about either later or at a later date. Well, the basic premise of the series, we'll be talking tonight about the pilot episode, which is called Identified. And the basic setup is that in the far-flung future, specifically the year 1980, well, you know, 69, it was 10 years in the future, Earth has been under attack for at least 10 years by alien invaders. And a secret organization, super secret organization, I mean a really, really secret organization known as Shadow, the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization, has been set up to defend the Earth against the aliens. As the series starts, we don't know where the aliens come from. We don't know what the aliens want. We don't know anything about the aliens all, except that they come here and they kill people, and they, more importantly, they abduct people. In command of the base is one Ed Straker, and I don't think he has a military rank. He's just known as Commander Straker, at least when in Shadow. He doesn't seem to have a rank, but he is the top dog. And he is, not only is he the commander of the base, but he is also, I think, probably the chief architect of a lot of the defense mechanisms. Not necessarily the technology, but in other words, he built Shadow. I mean, he is the man that brought life to the project. He's also the head of a movie studio, which the Shadow base is hidden deep underneath, so that no one will know that a high-tech military organization is operating there, because no one would notice anything strange going on underneath a movie studio. You could move anything in, from alien bodies to UFOs to military equipment, and people would just think it's part of a movie. There are a number of other characters on the show. Which ones? Which ones do you think we should mention, Ben? I mean, there's a bunch, but we don't need to carry everybody this week. But
well, I think Colonel Freeman.
Colonel Freeman.
Colonel Lieutenant Ellis. But you know, but definitely Colonel Freeman, because I think he was a very visible character.
He was in the episode a lot. What? How would you assess his personality?
A lecherous old man.
He does seem to be a bit of a lech, doesn't he? He is the second in command.
And he's trying to pass himself off as incredibly young. Well, it just made him even more lecherous as far as I was concerned. But obviously somebody that Commander Stryker really respects. He's Stryker's right-hand man.
And they couldn't be more different. I mean, Stryker is wound up so tight that you'd think you could pluck a tune if you hit the muscles in his neck. I mean, the man is rigid. And Freeman is this kind of, well, he's sort of free and sort of hip and now for this old man.
Everybody likes him. He walks into a room and people wave and smile at him and he waves back. I mean, he's Mr. Popularity.
And Mr. Pinch the Girls on the Butt. I mean, I don't think he does that in any of it. I think he might slap a couple, doesn't he?
If he has, I have not seen it.
But he definitely is leching on all of the nubile young ladies in the episode. He's an interesting character. And he's an older man. I don't know how old he is. What do you think he is? Late 40s?
Not based on his face, no, unless he aged very prematurely. I was literally thinking, I know nothing about the actor, but I kind of placed him, I would say in his early to mid-50s with a really bad-looking hairpiece to make him look younger.
Yeah, he has got this big mod hairpiece with the sideburns and everything. It really bespeaks badly of the 60s there. In that particular instance. And he is... he's very instrumental in the first episode, in addition to the series as a whole. We also have... I think Lieutenant Ellis is probably the next biggest character, and she is in command of the moon base, which Shadow has as part of its defensive network. In addition to the headquarters, we have a small base on the moon that contains three interceptor ships, which are designed to identify, with the help of SID, the Space Intruder Detector Satellite System, to identify incoming UFOs, which is what they call them rather than UFOs, and try to shoot them down out of the sky. Lieutenant Ellis is a young lady, very attractive. I don't think we really get a whole lot of her personality, but she doesn't actually come off very well in this episode to me, because she seems rather, well, a bit vain and a bit unconcerned about, like, an imminent UFO strike. But I'm going to pass that off and say, well, you know, they were trying to accomplish something else with the character. But and then finally, we have... Oh, I cannot remember his name now. Peter?
The
sub-commander. I think it's...
Yes, it's Captain Peter Carlin is his name.
Yes, Captain Carlin. That's right. In any case, he is the commander of Skydiver, which is also part of the Shadow Defense Network. And that is a high-tech underwater submarine that has... The front end is a launchable attack aircraft for when the UFOs make it into the Earth's atmosphere. The Skydiver launches Sky One, and they go after the UFO. So in the first episode, Identified, we are treated to a possibly, with just a couple of exceptions, a nearly perfect pilot episode setup. I have long complained about TV series pilots because they do not manage to work the information that you need to set up the show into a good first story. Quite typically, you'll see, you know, if it's an hour-long show, you'll see the first 45 minutes setting up what you need to know, and then 15 minutes of just, there's the story. You know, ooh, let's get one out of the way real quick so people don't feel cheated. And in the case of UFO, the entire episode from end to end is basically set up. It's just, they've kind of, there's not exactly a whole lot going on in it, but they've set up they've set up what you need to go along. The plot of the episode is straightforward. We start off by seeing, in the year 1970, a UFO attack on some civilians. We follow it up by seeing Colonel Straker of the U.S. Air Force and General Henderson, also of the U.S. Air Force, in England, preparing for a meeting with the Prime Minister. They're in a motorcade with a military escort on their way for this critical meeting, and a UFO comes along and attacks them, and it appears kills everyone except Straker, but it does destroy the evidence, and Straker is thrown out of the car before it explodes. We cut to 1980, where we now are introduced to the new super secret Shadow base, and we talk about the fact that Shadow has been 10 years in the making, and that it has just now come to the point where it's going to be fully operational. The last piece of the puzzle is the eutronic detection equipment, which will allow them to nearly instantaneously detect UFOs on an intercept vector to Earth, allowing them time to intercept and destroy them. The base has spent 10 years, and a lot of it has been set back by a lot of sabotage, which they suspect are the aliens. And so they feel that this is going to precipitate a UFO attack against the eutronic equipment, which they have to fly over from Los Angeles for installation at the Shadow Base and ultimately at Shadow Moon Base. So the story follows as the eutronic equipment is tried to be brought to Shadow, and the UFOs work their way past the various defensive mechanisms of Shadow, the moon base, the skydivers, etc. Ultimately, Shadow gets their eutronic equipment, and they also recover a live alien pilot. And from that, they're able to study the alien before he dies shortly thereafter, and determine, finally, what the reason is that the aliens are coming across space for. And that reason is body parts. They are abducting people to harvest their organs. So as pilot goes, not a whole lot happened. I mean, that's spread out over an hour, but they really were able to go out to all the places, to Skydiver, to Moonbase, to Shadow headquarters, to show the kind of military organization, the SST transports and the military hospitals. And I thought it was fairly effective at introducing everything, wouldn't you say?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that I observed while watching it, now I should point out that I never got to watch this series in its entirety when it first aired. I mean, I'm not even quite sure what that means. The show was syndicated, so it ran at very strange times when I remember when I was growing up, so I never saw the episodes in any kind of order. But one thing that became clear to me, especially after I watched the pilot, is that you made the statement that that this pilot episode, it sets up everything that we need to know. What I liked is that the series appears to be setting up all the information for us, the viewer, at the very same time it is setting it up for the characters in the show. They learn things at the same time we learn things.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the reasons why the show has got such a great storytelling quality to it.
Now, one of the interesting things that I should point out, you'll see a lot of controversy may not be the right word for it, But the program was filmed in two chunks. There was some sort of problem. The studio that they were working at closed, and so there was a long hiatus, and then they came back at a different studio. But this is still just 1 year's episodes. And they lost several members of the cast from the first half to the second half. So when they syndicated it, they showed them out of order in the, I guess, in the United States and elsewhere. They would take earlier episodes and later episodes and intersperse them so that you would get the feel that, for example, Colonel Freeman, who's one of the people who left, was there for the whole series. And that may have diminished the storytelling aspect of it as we learn along. I don't know, because I've only ever seen them in the production order. But neither here nor there. But it's interesting to note that there really is no, I guess, canon order that they're supposed to be shown.
There's no overall arc from what we can see. I mean, every once in a while, from my memory, there are episodes that might make reference to another episode. And if you were to see them out of order, it might cause a little bit of confusion. But for the most part, these were really much standalone episodes.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, as I said earlier, any information that we were learning, so were our cast of characters. So it gave it a really good even pace in terms of information reveal.
I think that's a fair assessment. Although I believe I can tip you off that there are a few episodes that will throw chunks out there that you could call story arc-ish kinds of things, but fortunately it's not particularly heavy, but you know, maybe the introduction of another major character or something of that nature.
Well, never having seen the entire series straight through, I could only come to the conclusion that I had. So I look forward to the opportunity now, at least through these podcasts, to be able to talk about these episodes now.
So there's a couple of areas that. So I mean, that's basically it. I mean, I enjoyed this program, and the pilot is a good setup, if not the fastest paced program. But I mean, it does have a nice bit of tension. You know, will they make it? Will they get the equipment? Will the base be operational? Will the moon base be able to intercept them? Will Skydiver be able to intercept them? And they do a very nice job of that. But there are a couple of areas that we should discuss that make UFO an interesting piece of time, a piece of history. One of which is, and I'll let you go first. How about their predictions for what we've got going in the year 1980?
Well, it's funny you said. You said in terms of things like fashion and like Straker's car and all these. And Colonel Freeman, you made the comment that it speaks badly of the 60s. I would say that it speaks badly of the 60s vision of the 80s. There's something that I always get a big kick out of trying to see some kind of, I mean, what we would call older television and their prediction of the future, especially something that we're way past now. It's – my God, I'll talk about the fashion.
Well, let me ask you a question now. When you say it speaks badly of their vision of the 80s, do you mean that, for example, in this show, the 80s appear to be an extension of the 60s, and so they think we'll still be the same? But at the same time, for crying out loud, they got moon base and spacecraft. And so, I mean, they had both. Some things aren't going to bother to change, and some things are going to change a lot.
Well, take a look at Arthur C. Clarke's 2001: A Space Odyssey. I mean, he had this whole vision that by 2001 we'd be flying ships to Jupiter, and with a moon base even before that. So there's nothing too uncommon about a 1960s vision as to what the future is going to hold in store. It's an optimistic one. And I just think they just picked a date. I mean, it's easier to say, well, it's 1960. Let's set a show in the future. It's easier in terms of production if we just make it just far enough in the future, say 1980, so that we can stylize things to make them look kind of far out based on our understanding, but still it's technology that is not only within conceivably in our reach, at least in terms of land-based, earth-based stuff, but at the same time, it kind of makes it a little bit easier for certain production values.
Do you think if somebody were putting together – I think that if somebody were putting together a show today, they would set it like 9,000 years in the future before we have a moon base, because we are so – back then we were so optimistic about the future and advances of technology, and now we're a bunch of crying old Luddites that – or it seems like we're run by a bunch of crying old Luddites that are ticking and clawing against moving forward. And, of course, they've had all our dreams of people having jetpacks smashed and flying cars over and over again that we didn't get that were promised in the 50s and the 60s. And so part of that is disillusionment. But I liked it better when they were optimistic.
Well, I did too. This was very prevalent in the culture. All you had to do is they're coming out of – I mean, I don't know. Were they still hip-deep in flower power kind of way of thinking?
In 1969? I think so, probably.
I mean, we're beginning to come out of the hippie movement. But we still have that optimism, and that's reflected by the clothes. I mean, they were very stylish in that time, and I think we should talk about Sylvia Anderson and her desires to be a fashionist for fashion, because that plays a definite role in the way our characters dressed.
I think that they thought that hippie movement or the mods or whatever that particular wave of style. Well, I think that they thought that would become mainstream. I think that's the whole purpose behind Alec Freeman, is I think, you know, by the time this guy gets to be old, you know, that's everybody's going to be hip and grooving like the young are now, kind of thing.
And it would be perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, but to us, it just looks...
Looks awful.
It looks awful. Yeah, it just looks so wrong. It looks like an old guy trying to pretend to be young. You know, get the big hair, get the fast car, try to get the young women. Midlife crisis. It says midlife crisis all over it.
It looks like he's going through his middle-aged crazies. When you look – let's talk about Sylvia Anderson.
Okay.
Because she definitely had a part to play in what they thought 1980 would look like.
Yes, mostly in the clothes, I think. I think mostly in the clothes. She thought that I think she designed the clothes. I won't swear to that, but she certainly had a hand in the design. Yeah, she designs by Sylvia Anderson, I believe.
I believe I've heard that too.
I think she may actually have credit for it, not just I know she had a hand in it, but she may actually have the credit at the end. Yeah,
she does have credit in the pilot. I remember that.
And they are interesting men in Nehru jackets. Straker's in – well, everybody's in Nehru jackets, essentially. The men wear makeup. I don't know if – I didn't notice it. Frankly, I don't notice these things. But my wife and I, when watching UFO, she used to just crack her up that Straker has, you know, mascara on. Lots of mascara on. And blue, as I recall. And – I don't know if it's that way in the pilot or whether it's just in some episodes, but she has pointed it out to me, and I mean, and Sylvia has said, you know, I think men will be more accepting of wearing makeup in the future, and wigs, and being more fashionable, it totally a miss. I think that's a predictive miss.
I will say this: having done theater myself, I learned that actors are required to put a little bit of eye makeup, just a bit, because it does bring the eyes out. Now, in the case of Stryker, I think there might have been this idea that Sylvia was playing with, kind of sort of a justification for the excessive mascara that he was wearing. But then again, maybe that kind of works for his character because it really brought his eyes out and it made him look way too intense.
I suppose it might have done that, yeah. I mean, he does have an intense, driven... but I thought that was just mostly demeanor and the 40-pack-a-day cigarillo habit he's got.
But the eyes, I mean, he's got these blue eyes that just pop.
Yeah.
They're like blue headlights. And one of the ways to help kind of bring that out would be a lot of excessive mascara. So it's possible that Sylvia was thinking about, this is the 1980s. We're going to be more unisexual. Who knows?
Well, so the people on the moon base are wearing these, or not the moon base, on the shadow base, wear kind of tan jumpers, which in the case of the nubile females are very tight. And wonderfully so, clapping for Sylvia there. On Skydiver, we'll go to Skydiver before we get to the moon. On Skydiver, the uniforms for the crew are, again, tannish, but the men's tops are these big weave netting. I mean, it looks like yarn, and the gaps have to be at least 2 centimeters across.
You could take these tunics and you could actually go into the ocean and fish.
They're big. Big netting. And so the men are wearing these shirts and their torsos and nipples and everything are showing through their outfits. And there's one woman on the sub and she's wearing the same outfit. And those crafty buggers, at least in the pilot, never position her in a way so that you can decide if she is actually wearing nothing under that fishnet. And I mean, it's clearly intentional camera work. It's just pure titillation. And I use that word with precision. What can we say about the fashions on Moonbase?
Lots of silver.
Yes.
Silver lamé.
And purple.
Lots of
hair.
Purple. Purple hair.
All the women wear purple wigs for some unknown reason. The men don't, but the women all do. And lots of eye makeup. I mean,
heavy eye makeup.
They make Stryker look like he's not wearing any eye makeup. It's so much.
It looks positively Egyptian.
Yeah, it's really... And they take time in their busy schedule while being attacked by UFOs to actually put on
maintain
some
their
more.
Makeup.
Yes. But the payoff had to be when Lieutenant Ellis puts the base on alert in about 45 minutes, I think. Like 45 minutes, we'll go on alert. So I'm going to take a break now. And she heads off to the recreation dome. And when she gets to the recreation dome, she goes into this little cubbyhole, which we see from another shot is like a changing room with a one-way mirror, so you're inside it and can see everybody out, but they can't see in while you're changing your clothes. But she's in there, and she's like ripping the arms off her clothes and ripping the legs off of her pants, and then she's got like a little piece
of cloth.
It's
like a bikini top almost.
Yeah, this little piece of cloth that she strings around to make about a 7 to maybe 8 inch miniskirt that then she can just walk the 25 steps to the chair and plunk down and have a coffee in.
God she's beautiful.
Oh, she is. I mean, she really is a gorgeous young lady. Or an old lady now, I suppose. I don't know. I don't even want to know. But
she was beautiful then.
She was beautiful back then. And that particular piece is in there for no reason whatsoever, other than to introduce us to the fashion of Moonbase and the style of leisure activity that they have available to them.
One of the things that it's funny you mentioned this whole introduction of leisure activity. In terms of the story, we're finding out that these UFOs travel fast, really, really fast. They can travel way beyond the speed of light. And they have one sort of on their scopes. They know it's coming their way, but it's way the heck out there. Well, okay, I have a lot of issue regarding this, but the thing that kind of boggles my mind is if they know that these things can travel so fast, they put the base on yellow alert, and then Lieutenant Ellis has enough time to go down, change, stretch out with a coffee or some kind of drink on this very hip, stylish, 60s kind of looking, very bright primary color chair. I remember when I watched that, I thought, this has got to be the most inappropriate thing in terms of the story, as far as I was concerned, and their whole mission. And it almost came across as like some sort of a Hilton Hotel for the Moon. It had that kind of a relaxed mentality, especially given the nature of the mission. They were briefed that this special equipment was being transported, compliments of or under the protection of Colonel Freeman. They knew that the aliens would be interested in it. They knew that a UFO was going to be coming their way, and yet we're just going to sit down here and I'm just going to have a nice coffee after I change. It just felt very, very strange. But again, as you said, this was really an attempt, and a rather unnecessary one, I think.
I think this piece was. Yeah.
It was very, very unnecessary. I mean, I think it could have been done in a much better way at a much better time. But then to do that, maybe you'd have to drop some of the tension. And something that you said earlier is they ratchet up the tension and they keep it that way from the beginning of the episode pretty much to its resolution. So if you're going to have that tension this high all the time, you can't afford to show scenes like this.
Yeah, it is odd.
Which puts the whole thing out of it just makes it very, very inappropriate. But again, as you said, this is to kind of show off what the society was and to really give Sylvia Anderson a chance to show what she could do in terms of costume design.
Yeah, I think yeah, because clear the whole scene is just to show Ellis strip basically out of that outfit and go into her changeable, convenient, go from business to fun wear in no time. Anyway, but that does bring up something else when you talk about how it doesn't fit and how the aliens are coming in so quick. On the flip side of it, one thing that I am very impressed about UFO, and I'm going to be paying a little more attention to it now. The first time I watched through the series, I didn't really put two and two together. I just kind of worked on that whole standard, you know, they're just pulling stuff out of their rear ends when it comes to technical stuff. But throughout the course of the show, the series, they will refer to the speed of the UFOs in terms of a non-existent measurement, which are measured as sols. And in this particular episode, the UFO is coming in at sol 8, which I assume means 8 sols. And
we should point out when you say sols, we're saying S-O-L-S.
S-O-L, sol, yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, sol as in the sun kind of thing. So I suppose you could say maybe that's meant to be light speed. I mean, that's kind of... But, you know, I've always sort of rejected that. as I've watched the show. And in the past, is like, well, that's just ridiculous. If the thing was coming in at 8 times the speed of light, it'd shoot past them so fast that they'd never, well, they wouldn't see it. Frankly, at that speed, you wouldn't see it. It would get there before the light reached you.
It would make conventional tracking pretty much ridiculous.
Which is sort of the point of the Utronic equipment, which is supposed to have near instantaneous detection across extremely long distances, faster than light. Which, of course, is totally absurd, I suppose, but, you know, necessary, considering. But what I was getting at is that somewhere else in the episode, they talk about the UFO traveling at 1.5 million miles per second. And, which, you know, is a staggeringly ridiculous figure, and again, you know, this is up. But I just happened to do the math, and it turns out that that is darn near exactly, and if you want to round it, it is exactly. Well, can you have exactly when you're rounding? But anyway, 8 times the speed of light, or Sol 8. So, in the future, I'm going to see if we can't, you know, catch them out on some errors with regards to their speeds of the UFOs coming in. And they do point out that the UFOs have to slow down when they get to the Earth because of the atmosphere. And the fact that at 8 times the speed of light, they wouldn't be... if they were traveling through our atmosphere at 8 times the speed of light, you know, where would they go? Just be gone, kind of thing. But what impressed me about that, I'm not just rambling, what impressed me about that is that they got it right. I mean, in two different places in the course of the episode, they make up an imaginary speed, which we now know isn't an imaginary speed, and then they at least did the math. Unlike, you know, you ever watch Blake 7? What the heck speed are they traveling at? Standard by 4. What's that? We never find out. And then the bad guys are all moving at time to sport 6. It's like, you can't put the two, of course that may be intentionally, you can't put the two together or get any kind of feel for how fast they're traveling. But if we know that the aliens can travel at 8 times the speed of light, well then we can have a rough idea of how possibly far that they travel. There is some evidence that they traveled for extremely long periods of time, perhaps months or years in the UFOs, based on the autopsy of the pilot. But the whole thing comes down to this. They cared. They actually, when they made this show, they have an ounce, or they, it feels like to me, they have more than an ounce of integrity. That they're actually trying to put together a serious science fiction program, or at least science fiction-ish melodrama program, that isn't insulting to the audience, that isn't talking down to the audience, that is trying to build up a realistic military organization, a realistic cover story, a relatively realistic moon base, you know, and technology, that the whole thing is honest. It's nonsense, of course, but it's an honest storytelling. They're not just, you know, oh heck, we can just use any old thing and the audience will buy it. They actually tried to make it.
Well, they tried to give it some sense of credibility, I think.
Yeah, and I would buy it. I mean, if it were in 1970, I would have bought it, because in 1980, obviously, we'd have all those things. But now you look at it and go, well, it doesn't. But nonetheless, trying to divorce yourself of that, say, then it's credible. It is a credible program, and well, I enjoy it for that.
I think that's one of the things that really sets it apart. As you said, I mean, I remember when I was watching as a kid, I mean, I had no idea if such a thing would happen in terms of the UFOs coming to Earth like that. But, yeah, I thought, yeah, this is possible. We might have – okay, they have this vehicle. When they're transporting their personnel from the Earth to the moon, there is this phenomenal plane where – part of its fuselage, when it's in the upper atmosphere, detaches, becomes a rocket, lands on the moon like a rocket, takes off like a rocket, and then reattaches itself to the wings in the upper atmosphere for coming to a landing. I saw that as a kid and thought, you know, we'll be doing that. We're going to be doing that by 1980.
I think it was all based on stuff that you know had been plausibly put forward as possible future space exploration vehicles. Yeah,
which again goes towards the research that the production staff did. Whoever was in charge, I don't know if it was Jerry and Sylvia, I don't know if it was writers. Whoever was responsible, I mean, at least somebody was doing that kind of research.
I'll do a head spoiler for a later episode. It's not a spoiler like it'll ruin anything for you. But there is a whole episode coming up dedicated to Straker trying to get the International Space Commission to clean up all the junk in Earth orbit, all the space debris
space
that's up
junk.
There. And that is a real problem now. I mean, they just had to move the ISS a week or two ago to get out of the way of some of this old junk that's up there in the orbit. And, you know, they have an episode where Straker is pointing out that that's an extreme hazard to the navigation and to the defense of the Earth for his ships and his moon shuttles, which, of course, have to be secret because nobody knows anything about Shadow except for the shadowy underworld of the International Space Commission and whatnot. But, you know, that somebody actually sat down and read about real space travel in terms of what it might be like and what the real problems would be. And I appreciate that. I really appreciate that about this program.
Someone was clearly doing their scientific research. And as we were saying, when we saw this, in 1970, I mean, it seemed very credible, at least in terms of what might be available. Possibly having a moon base, possibly having these interceptors, or the concept of the flying sub. I mean, all these things seemed like they could really happen. Now, of course, I mean, obviously, we look back on it now and said, "Well, boy, that was a long shot, wasn't it?" You know, but because they did take time to craft something that has a lot of integrity, you can look back on it now, and even though you can say, yeah, well, that certainly didn't happen, you can still look at it and appreciate the work that went into making this show.
Well, in summary, from my point of view, this particular episode is a good introduction to the series. I love the series. And I'm looking forward to going through the rest of the episodes with it. So, you know, it gets my two thumbs up, because I have two thumbs. Not many people know that, but I have two thumbs up for me on this show. And what did you...
what's your assessment? Opposable thumbs.
Yeah, well, one of them's opposable. The other one's kind of a semi-opposable thumb. It really opposes the other opposable thumb, which makes it an opposable thumb.
I'm sorry I said anything. As far as the show is for me, as you were just giving high marks to UFO, I started thinking back to, you know, when I saw a few of the episodes as a kid, I thought, my God, this is great. And I remember feeling the exact same way. To kind of go back an episode or two of our podcast, that's how I felt about Star Lost. When I saw the pilot, I thought, oh my God, this is great. And then as I had the great pleasure of being able to watch these things today in the cold light of day, all I can say is, oh my God, these things are crap. I can't say that about UFO. I am a big fan of Jerry and Sylvia Anderson's. I love their work. They work with Derek Mettings a lot, the special effects expert.
Right. All of this was Derek Mettings' work. Yeah.
And he has a certain style, a certain aesthetic to all of his effects, which I personally love. And as much as I loved Supercar, Stingray, Thunderbirds, all these Superman Nation shows, clearly UFO seems like an evolution into this in the genre. And it didn't fail. It still holds up. It may seem terribly dated, but that doesn't take anything away from it. I love this show. I enjoyed the pilot. And it's a very cerebral show. I do remember one or two episodes that were I kind of wondered if maybe somebody wasn't smoking some pot at the time they wrote the story, because some of these are real head trips.
But okay. Some of them are later are definitely drug induced.
Episodes. But that's not necessarily a detriment towards the show. I kind of actually like that. They're forcing the viewer to sort of expand their consciousness, man, if you will, while watching the show. So all I can say is that I think this is a really, really great TV series, and I can't wait to see more episodes.
It's funny how you look at the shows that you liked when you were a kid, and it's no indicator whatsoever of if you'll like them when you're an adult.
True.
I don't know what the discriminating bit is that gets flipped in your mind as you get older, but at some point, some of the shows just get chucked off to the side and say, well, that was just terrible. And others go, you know, there are shows that, like Space 1999, which is their follow-up show, which I enjoyed more later when I watched it again, because I got it. And I didn't necessarily get parts of the... I got the melodrama when I was a kid, but I didn't get the concept that they were going for until I watched it later on, and I realized, oh, see, they're trying to tell me something, and I just didn't get it as a kid. And, well, only in the first year of Space 1999, but it's something...
Well, I think the point that you're trying to make here is that, you know, and I don't want to veer too far off onto another topic, but basically, I mean, as we were growing up, I mean, we had this plethora of shows, you know, they came from all these different eras, and they were they completely spanned the range from great to garbage. But we didn't have the that little discriminating factor flipped on yet. It just hadn't been turned on because we were too young. As we get older and older, and you know, as we become a little bit more sophisticated in our thinking, that starts to play. That's that filter comes in, and some things fall right through that filter and some things don't. And I think that's why we can take a look at a show like you know compare Star Lost to UFO and say, well, Star Lost is garbage, but UFO clearly isn't. It did stand the test of time.
So the question is, though, does that mean that we have lost our sense of childlike wonder? Is that what we lost to get the ability to discern between good and bad?
The loss of innocence.
Well, on that heady, deep, thoughtful point, I suppose we'll leave you until next time. So, Ben, glad having you on the show again tonight.
Oh, it was good to be here.
And we hope to you hear us all again on the next episode. A Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol, or look for us on Facebook. Fusion Patrol is a production of Lone Locust Productions. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.
His name was Peter Gordeno. He was from Burma.
Burma's kind of close to India.
Yeah. And he was... For anybody who's really into... 1980s music. He was a session musician and member of the touring band Depeche Mode.
Seriously?
Seriously.
I've heard of them. They're a band.
So. Oh, I take that back. I'm sorry. there are actually two Peter Gordanos. that's what threw me.
Well, that's kind of funny. Thank you. Thank you, Wikipedia, right?
Exactly. Two Peter Gordanos, and I'm looking at the wrong one.